Our second scripture today comes to us from the very beginning of the Bible, Genesis 1, beginning with the first verse. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. This is the word of the Lord. Well, today we're at our very first Sunday in a very brand new 2019, and we're going to start a new sermon series here. For 6 weeks, we're going to just talk about what I call questions that thinking people ask. But really, what these questions are, they're the existential questions, the life questions, the big questions. You know, ones that no matter where we are in our life, we at some point ask these questions. And today we're starting off with this very first one. We're going to ask this question: what about the findings of science in relation to God? We hear a lot about this these days. What about these two things that seem to bump up against each other? And we ask this question first because it's going to have an impact on all the other things that we talk about. And it's really about the existence of God. It shapes how we respond to life and how we respond to these other questions. And the truth is, it doesn't matter if you grew up in a non-believing home, if it was an atheist or an agnostic home, or if it was a faithful, believing Christian or Jewish home, it doesn't matter. If at some point in your life, you ask yourself these questions: what about God? Where is God? Does God exist? What about people who suffer? What about violence in the world? Why do these things happen? And at some point, you have that conversation where somebody's talking about Dawkins' book or Harris's book or somebody, and they say, "Well, you know, I don't even know if God really exists." It doesn't matter where you come from, you ask yourself these questions. Are the scientists correct? Is my pastor correct? Now, the truth is, you came to a church this morning. So I think you know what my answer is going to be, right? So I'm already setting this up for you. But we definitely all ask these questions about what we believe with God. In that little bulletin you got, there's a set of sermon notes in there if you want to follow along. It's just an outline to help us think and help us answer questions that might come up to us. And you know, my prayer is always that God would speak to us during this time. If there's something you want to write down, write it down. It might be valuable later. So first of all, let's get something. When we deal with these big existential questions, let's just put something right out there at the beginning. I believe these answers come from two places. Okay, so the first place that they come from is science and the universe, natural law. We learn these things and we get answers from them. That's one area. And the other area is our own personal experience. We travel through life and things happen to us and we respond and we have emotions and we react and we do different things. We have feelings. We get information from our personal experience. So we take this natural law, science, the natural world, we take that and we take our feelings and our emotions and what we understand in our heart language, and we bring those two things together, and that's how we answer these tough questions that we come up with. Now, I want to say something, first of all, especially as we talk about this first subject, when it comes to atheism and agnosticism. I have a lot of empathy for those who are in those two camps. An atheist is a person who says, "I have enough knowledge, I believe and know there is no God." Done. The agnostic, on the other side, is the one who says, "Well, I don't really know. I don't think there's a God, but I don't have enough data, enough information to really make a decision, but I'm over here questioning, and I just don't really think there is a God." Now, in the atheist camp, that's a person who says, "I have enough knowledge that there is no God." Now, for me, that seems like an impossible place for any person to be. When a person says, "I have enough knowledge, I know there is no God, story's over," I have to say, really? That seems to be beyond human capacity. But I have empathy for them and for these agnostics that are trying to figure it out, okay? And that's an important thing that we really want to understand as we go into this. You know, one of the most famous agnostics was Einstein himself. And he talked about God during his whole career, but he said, "I'm an agnostic." And he had an attitude about God, an attitude about faith, an attitude about religion, and this is what he said. He said, "I have an attitude of humility corresponding with the weakness of our intellectual understanding of nature and our own being." So Einstein approaches this with humility. He says, "There's no way I could attain enough information to say there is no God." That was his stance. That's where he was, an agnostic all his life. And he talked about God regularly. When you read Einstein, when you read what people wrote about him, he talks about God regularly. And he saw God as that force. He saw God as that dark matter that held everything together, right? The stuff in between. That's how he saw God. Okay? That's where he was. That's what he knew from physics. So he remained an agnostic. And the way I feel is God has great patience. He has great empathy and great compassion for people who are in all of these places. But the truth is, God doesn't make it easy for us to believe in him sometimes. And to be totally honest with you, the church makes it really hard for us to believe in him sometimes. And that's just the way it is. The church, people of faith, make it difficult for other people to believe in God. So when it comes down to this specific subject, I can understand why scientists and intellectuals have a tough time with faith, why they have a tough time with us, and they find it difficult to accept the claims of Christianity, despite the fact that for centuries it was people of faith who were making the advancements in science, despite the fact that for centuries it was good, faithful people who were making all of these great advances in science. You know, think about it. All the great universities came from the church. Oxford, Cambridge, Yale, Princeton, Harvard, they all came out of the church, out of faithful people. Our own church founder, John Wesley, was a fellow at Oxford's Lincoln College. He taught philosophy and theology. That's where we come from. For centuries, that's the way it was. And these two things existed together. They coexisted. They were melded together. And then you get to, you know, if you go back and you see Galileo and Kepler and Newton, what happened with Galileo was wrong. That was a misuse of the church. There's no doubt about that. Nonetheless, these things all came from faithful, believing Christians until we get to the 19th century. And then in the 19th century, this animosity starts to happen between Christians and the church, this animosity. That's why I call this science versus God, because it's become a competition, you know. And I have to be honest with you, almost all of it's the church's fault. When you look at what happened to Galileo and how unfortunate that was, the church had a really tough time dealing with the fact that just possibly the earth is not the center of the universe. So what'd they do? They put Galileo under house arrest. We know a lot more now, right? So we know how wrong that was. That was a big mistake. But you get to the 19th century and along comes Darwin and evolutionary theory, and then we have church people having a really tough time trying to deal with the fact that maybe in creation, there can be evolution of species. Things can change over time. All right? Well, it doesn't say that in the Bible, so I can't believe that. And that's where a big mistake started to happen. That's where we started to go down the wrong path. People started to think, well, it's all under the guiding hand of God, but this part here can't happen, and these kinds of things happen, it's outside the Bible because the Bible doesn't say that. And people started to take the Bible literally and fundamentally. And when they do that, they start adding some things up and they take all these genealogies and they're trying to start make science fit. That's the problem right there. If you take science and try to make it fit into your view of the Bible, you're misusing Scripture. All right? So there were people who took these genealogies in the Bible and they added them all up and they came down through time. And then when they looked back, they said, aha, the earth was created in September of 4004 BC. And they're like, oh boy, you know, which means, tick, 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 the flood, the great flood happened in 2400. Tick, 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 and then the ice age happened after that, which means the dinosaurs had to be in the ark. So you start making these assumptions, you start looking at these things, and scientists look at that and they say, well, if that's what religion's about, my job is to refute that, because I have a whole different set of data. So you see what happens there when we start to look at the Bible as a science lesson. When people look at Genesis and they read what we just read and they said, that's a science lesson, you're headed down the wrong path already. Okay, so that's a problem. That's where we find ourselves. Because there's this earth view that some Christians have held on to that the planet is 6,000 years old. And we have to be careful with that and how we line up the dinosaurs and the ice age and all those different things. It doesn't add up. And it's a misuse of the Bible when we do that, because scientists will line themselves up against that. Hence the name of this message, Science versus God. And we find ourselves in this continual battle. This all has not been helpful at all. It hasn't been helpful to science. It hasn't been helpful to us as Christians. And I'm just saying that when you take the Bible literally and you start to defend it that way as if it's a science textbook, around every corner there's going to be another issue that you have to defend, and you're not going to win. Okay, so we have to think about biblical interpretation. You look at that first six chapters of Genesis, and you look at that and you say, that's a science text, you're already headed in the wrong direction, all right? I don't think God ever intended to have a science lesson at the beginning of the Bible, because the truth is it's liturgy, it's Hebrew poetry. We read these words and we see this sweeping, undeniable truth that says, in the beginning, God, you know? And we're like, wow, before anything else, there was God. Now that's a truth that we need to handle and stick to. And the earth was formless and void, and darkness covered it, right? And God said, let there be light. And God said, this is good. You know, so what we get out of this is we get that before anything else was, there was God. Period. That's our understanding. It's not meant to say in the first six chapters of Genesis, the world was created in September 7th, 4004 BC. That's just not part of the story. Then you get to Genesis chapters 2 and 3, right? And you see Adam and Eve and the serpent. What's that story about? Is that a science text? No, that's your story. And it's my story. And what Genesis 2 and 3 is saying is that we all hear the voice of the serpent. Every day we have to listen to the serpent talking to us through our hearts, through our heads. And we have a choice to make. Do we follow the serpent or do we follow the word of God? Do we follow one of those two things? It's not a science lesson. And we know what happens if we follow the serpent. Marriages are broken. We fight wars that should never be fought over crazy things that should never even come up. The world is broken because we sometimes choose to listen to the serpent, and all kinds of things happen out there. All right? These stories define you and they define me. They're archetypal. They deal with all of humanity. It's not a science lesson. You know, and then the flood comes, right? So the flood comes and God looks down and he says, there's just violence everywhere. This is awful. I can't believe this is absolutely terrible. It sounds like CNN. Sounds like the 6 o'clock news to me. You know, God looks at this, but God, our eternal optimist, says, I'm going to give them one more chance. God always does that, right? I'm going to pick out a family. I'm going to give them one more chance. And that's what God does. That's part of your story, too. Get one more chance. One more time. Get to do it all over again. So we read that story and we say, gee, I'm reading this story. I think that happened around 2400 BC. If you're headed down that road, you're already off track. It's not about the date. It's about the story that is your story and my story. Okay, so what I'm trying to say here is I can understand how the intellectuals and the atheists feel. I can understand that because they see what we sometimes have taken and tried to put into a timeline in a science text, and they said, I just don't get it. In fact, Steven Weinberg's a theoretical physicist who won the Nobel Prize in 79. He looks at this stuff, and here's what he says. He says, the world needs to wake up from the long nightmare of religion. Anything we scientists can do to weaken the hold of religion should be done, and may in fact be the greatest contribution to civilization. The greatest contribution to civilization is wiping out religion? Really? Now, the greatest contribution, I think, could be medical advances and our expanding, lengthening life, expectancy in here. How about our crop yields? We create so much food. We feed a whole planet with what scientists has done in our crop yields. But wiping out religion? I've already said that it was religion that began most of all of our universities and colleges. Pretty much all of our hospitals come out of religion. I've told people this before. I said, if your atheist friend says, you know, I don't believe in God, I say, when they call 911 and he or she's having a heart attack, give the ambulance driver the instructions to take him to the closest hospital that wasn't started by a small group of faithful believers a couple hundred years ago. I don't think one exists. They'll be driving for a long time. Wipe out religion? Really? And the truth is, when I get on a plane and I head down to Haiti, or I get on a plane and go to Costa Rica like we're going to do next month, or I get in a van full of sweaty kids and drive to Oklahoma, all those people around me, 99% of the people on those planes who are going to do medical work or feed or construction, they're all faithful Judeo-Christian believing people who want to go and do something. They have a call in their life to do something good. They're going out and doing that. You going to wipe all that out? No, I don't think so. I don't think so. And the truth is, would we like the planet if that actually happened? But what has happened since that 19th century is a whole host of those scientists who are in the camp of atheists have taken up that challenge. They say it's our job to make sure people understand that they're wrong. And what I want to tell you today is you can be a scientist, you can be an intellectual, and be a person of very strong faith. There's a whole history of these people in our lives, okay? Names come up like Max Planck. Max Planck was the one who originated quantum theory. We have a picture of Max. So Max Planck is the one who originated quantum theory, and he was a person of faith, and he said this: all matter originates and exists only by virtue of a force which brings the particle of an atom to vibration and holds this most minute solar system together. Max is talking about quantum theory and dark matter. We must assume behind this force the existence of a conscious and intelligent mind is the matrix of all matter. That's Max Planck, quantum theory. Then I think, what about George Lemaître? We have a picture of George Lemaître hanging out with Einstein. George Lemaître was the one who proposed the Big Bang Theory. You know the Big Bang Theory. There was nothing, and then bang, there was everything, and it's been expanding ever since. This photograph of Albert Einstein, you notice George Lemaître is wearing a collar. He was also a Catholic priest. Did George Lemaître ever think that his science and his faith were battling with one another? No, he saw them as being close and merged together. He saw them part of the same story. Okay? He didn't see those things as being enemies. Francis Collins led the project to unravel the human genome. Okay? John Polkinghorne, he was a man of deep faith. John Polkinghorne was a professor of mathematics at Cambridge for 13 years until he got his other calling to become an Anglican priest. He remained at Cambridge, but instead of just teaching mathematics, he also taught theology. Okay, these are people of deep faith. Alan Sandage. Alan Sandage is probably the foremost astronomer of the 20th century, and here's what he said at the end of his life. You know, everything that I have learned has also led me to the conclusion that there is a God, and he followed Jesus Christ. This is my point. Not all smart people are atheists. Okay? Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, they get all the news. But you can be a scientist and be a faithful believer also. These two things are not enemies of each other. Okay? How do we reconcile this? How do we look at this as faithful people? You know, and we just turn to the very beginning of the Bible, which we just read, and we read those words, in the beginning God. All right? And the earth was formless and empty and void, and darkness covered the earth. And you know something? The physicists and biologists say that it all came out of nothing. It all came out of this chaos. This is the primordial chaos. We have it right there in scriptures. This is the nothingness. And then right after that, bang! The Big Bang happens, right? And then everything begins to expand. You know, when I think about God and how we define God, I think there's two broad ways of defining God, and Einstein is the one who grasped onto this first way, and that is God as a force. God as that binding energy, that dark matter that holds everything together. You know, and what Einstein would say is, without that energy, without that dark matter, nothing exists. So Einstein, having the humility that we mentioned earlier, would never separate that from possibly being God. That's what made him an agnostic. You know, for the scientist and the physicists, they look at that dark matter, those elemental forces that hold the world together, all right? So Einstein could talk about God that way, as this convening force, this force that made the whole world stick together. And what he would say is, apart from that force, there is nothing. That's what holds it all together. Now you and I, we see God as something else. We see God as something personal. Einstein would never go to see that force, that God, as something personal that was involved in our lives and doing things. But that's where we go. We see God as a personal force in our lives, and we describe him as personhood and what makes up the individual person. We say, hey, we're made in his image, not his physical image. We're not made God's physical image, but we have intellect and emotion and relation, and we have feelings, and we have all these things that are characteristic of God that are not characteristic of any of the rest of the planet. Okay, that comes from God. We've been created in that image. And then we look to the story of Moses. You know, we get up to Exodus, and there's Moses. He's talking to the burning bush that is not consumed, standing on holy ground. And the bush, God, says to him, go off and save my people. You're going to free Israel from the captivity in Egypt. And Moses comes up with a very good question. He says, well, there's lots of gods. Who should I say I'm being sent by? And remember what God says? He says, you tell them, I am that I am. Like, wow, that's a weird name for God. But I think what God is saying to Moses is, I am it. I am everything. I'm what holds everything together. Nothing exists without me. And you go tell them that the force of the universe is sending you to set these people free. The stuff that permeates everything that exists. This omnipresence of particles, right? That's what God says in Exodus. In the same way, God is everywhere. He permeates everything. And this is what Christians believe. We believe that God is the force, and we believe that God is personal and present and doing all those things, not impersonal, here with us now. And you know, Paul pulls this together in Acts 15. Paul comes to the thinking center of the world. He's in Athens, and he's before all of the philosophers. And Paul says to them in Acts 15, he says these incredible words, "In him, in God, we live and move and have our being." How profound is that? You know, I think when Einstein reads that, he's like, Paul's got it. I think Paul's got it together. Einstein gets that. He has challenges when we say God is personal. But for us, we look at the universe and we look at all these patterns, and we look at the patterns in the universe and we say there's logic to it. There's a creative mind there. This is beautiful. Where did all these natural laws come from? How did they arise? Was it just by chance? Did they happen on their own? No, as Christians, we say there's some artist there. There's some creator putting it together and making it beautiful for us. All these wonderful things. And I see the handiwork of God everywhere. Let's bring up that first Hubble Space Telescope picture. This is one of the pictures that comes back to us from the Hubble telescope, okay? So if you take a postage stamp and you held that postage stamp up to the sky, about the size of your thumbnail, you look at that, the picture you're seeing on the screen right now is about the size of that postage stamp. Now just think how big the sky is around the whole planet, all right? One postage stamp covers this amount of space. Can you imagine how big the universe is? And if you go to the next picture is our galaxy, okay? So if you look at the Milky Way galaxy, can you see where we are there? That is a galaxy that has, what the scientists say, somewhere between 400 and 800 billion stars in it. I looked it up. I'm getting the numbers right, okay? So I know these are hard to fathom. Somewhere in our galaxy, between 400 and 800 billion stars. Now go back to that picture of the Hubble telescope. Every one of those points of light is a galaxy with a sun and a center just like ours, all containing 400 to 800 billion stars in it. That is one postage stamp against the sky. Okay? In our galaxy alone, we have a black hole in the middle just holding it all together, all those billions. To travel across our galaxy, scientists say it would take tens of thousands of light years to do this, to travel to another galaxy, hundreds of millions of light years to travel in this space. Now, when you look at this and you think about this, do you look at that and you say, there's no way there's a God? Or are you like me, you say, wow, God is so huge. How did he put all this? This is amazing. How do these laws of nature affect all of this space? And I'm so small. I look at that image and I think about the psalm that John read to us, the heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands. You know, having that Hubble telescope going out into the vast reaches does not diminish God for me one bit. I look at that and I just say, the artistry that God shows in the heavens is amazing. And you know the story of the Big Bang Theory, right? Big Bang Theory, 13.8 billion years ago, all of the energy, everything was on the head of a pin. Some scientists will admit it's the size of a dime. They all say it's down, it's the head of a pin. And then something happened, bang, and it's been expanding ever since, okay? Well, we look at that and we say, well, you know, that's not too bad because in a flash, in a moment, energy was released and all these things happen. You know, Einstein looked at this and he and some other scientists were like, yeah, that's a great theory, George. I don't know, I can't accept it. You know, I couldn't, he was really hesitant to accept it because as soon as he accepted it, he had to acknowledge the presence of something else. What was before the head of the pin? And then as scientists, you have to come up with parallel universe theories and you have to come up with, oh, things always existed and all these other things to support it. But as soon as you do that, you have to deal with the unknown. And it's a very unsettling idea for many scientists. The way that happened. You have to explain it without a God. But for us Christians, we go, yeah, God said, let there be light, and bang. You know, it's just common for us. It's second nature to us. That's That's what Christians and scientists both, they both believe that something came out of nothing. Life springs forth out of nothing. And we just say, well, you know, that was God. Scientists have to figure it out. And you know something? I appreciate that. Go get more data. Go get more. Because you're supporting my belief. I can make these two things work together. This is not a competition for me. I'm a believer in this. We hear that poetry, that liturgy, that Hebrew poetry in Genesis coming through in that. In any case, something, everything came out of nothing. All right? And then Fred Hoyle, who is another atheist scientist, came along and he's talking about the odds of this actually happening. And Fred Hoyle says, well, it's the same odds as if a hurricane comes along and it sweeps through a junkyard. And when this hurricane gets done sweeping through the junkyard, what the hurricane leaves behind is a perfectly formed Boeing 747 ready to take off. So another scientist took that and put it, actually more than one took it and put it into numbers, and he said the chances of that happening are 1 times 10 to the 40,000th power. Anybody play the lottery here? Don't raise your hand. I don't know, what are those odds? 1 in 50, 500 million or 50 billion? I don't know what it is. Imagine a 10 with 40,000 zeros behind it, and that being the odds of that happening. So we look at this and we say, well, you know, I get that, but it's really all about what God did, not about the odds of it happening. I'm okay with that. I'm okay with that. I'm okay. And I'm saying, look, if you believe one way or you believe another way, I'm not saying you're goofy or silly. I'm just saying these two things can come together. They don't have to compete. Just seems to me that there ought to be some great intelligent and artistry, some being behind all of these things. You know, I look at nature and I say, wow, how can this not be part of God's work? Snowflakes. Let's bring up the snowflake. You know, I look at these snowflakes and you can't count all the snowflakes, right? But they're all so beautiful. And we don't get to see that. Only God gets to see that. Who was he making that for? Someday we would create a lens that we could look at that, I guess, but God sees every one of those. I look at that and I say, wow. Or how about your DNA, that chain of material that makes up your software? How about that? Boy, that sure looks intelligent to me too. There's a pattern to that. Or how about something else, the thorny lizard in the desert? Have you ever looked at one of these things and you say, that's creativity right there? Or the platypus. You ever think about the platypus? Who would ever put a beak on a mammal? Oh my gosh. I look at these things and I say, there's something else at work here. How about a baby? If you don't get those other things, look at that. How do you feel when you look into those eyes? There's something deeper there, right? Those blue eyes. And how about when you hold that baby? Where does that feeling come from? I look at all these things and I see the handiwork of God. I see the pattern of the universe. I just see something so much greater than two cells splitting and exiting a swamp billions of years ago. Okay, to wrap this up, this is really the last idea. We look at these things. We look at all these things I'm talking about. And we as faithful believers, we say there is a personal God. Yes, there's God that is vibrating and holds everything together, and we're learning more about that, and science is going such, but we look at it and say it's just this simple. When I pray, I feel peace. You know, and when I'm with you and we're studying scripture and we're eating a meal together, I feel fellowship. And how about some things that happened in your life and you feel ashamed? Why do you feel ashamed? Where does that feeling come from? Do you think those things that hold everything together are giving you a little message? You shouldn't do that. That's the serpent talking to you. Look, I'll be honest with you. In growing up and creating my own faith, I would listen to people's personal experiences of God, and I'd walk away and I'd go, wow, they're wacky. And then I would get on down the path, and I'd have my own personal experience, and I'd say, you know something? I look back, and the stuff that I was praying for in 1998, there were two sets of footprints in the sand. I just didn't know it. And all those things worked out. And God was there every minute of the time. I mean, I value science. I value Darwin's theory. I value all of those things, natural selection. But, you know, our faith, this calling that we have from God, wants us to push back against that. It wants us to push back and say, I'm here. I did this for you. Let's not make an excuse for it. There's that force that's drawing us in all these things. The I am is there, calling your name. There's a voice. Whether it's the little vibrations beckoning you, it doesn't matter to me. It's God and its presence. And the truth is, I can't prove to an atheist that God exists. And I can't prove to you that God doesn't exist. But you know something? When I read Dawkins, The Late Great Planet Earth, or I read Sam Harris, the delusion, God delusion, all these things, I don't read that and become an atheist. I read that and I say, well, there's some places where he made a good point, and there's some places where he really got it wrong. Because that's my faith, that's my belief. That's the movement of God in my life. Science and God. It wasn't a textbook that made me believe. It was finding hope and meaning and joy in my life. You do that for me. We do that for each other. And we move forward. Because in the decisions that I've made in my life, there's a voice that speaks to me. And that has fundamentally changed me forever. We're made in the image of God. Let's pray.